my early research with immigrant women in Canada, the theories of identity at the time didn't do justice to the experiences of these women, and it also didn't address issues of power in their lives. I therefore developed a theory of identity as a site of struggle, changing across time and place, and indexical of learners' hopes for the future. I've been honored with many invitations to share these ideas with the global community.
Welcome to the Blue Hour. I am Farha Guerrero. Tonight I speak with Bonnie Norton, who was born and raised in Johannesburg, South Africa, in the turbulent apartheid years. She learnt at an early age that there is a complex relationship between language, power, and identity. But first, let's start the night with a favorite song of hers, Scatterlings of Africa by Johnny Clegg and Savuka.
Of Africa, I'm journeying to the sky.
Bonnie Norton, I want to congratulate you on recently receiving the Killam Professorship at the University of British Columbia.
Well, thank you very much, Farha. And so wonderful just to hear that Johnny Clegg and Savuka's Scatterlings of Africa. It's it always just touches my soul just to hear that vibrancy and energy and poignancy around diaspora Africans, which is what I am, originally from South Africa, but very privileged and delighted, of course, to be recognized as a University Killam Professor at UBC.
Tell us a little more about that song in the context of your life. Its lyrics explore the myriad dislocations experienced by many South Africans.
Well, interestingly, as much as, of course, the lyrics mean a great deal to me, I also happen to know Johnny Clegg. I don't think he knew me, but I knew him when I was living in South Africa and was actually on the faculty at Wits University in Johannesburg. And he was an anthropologist and worked on musicology. And we shared an interest in social change in the South African context, and worked on a committee for people who had been detained. This is in the apartheid era. It was called the Detainee Parent Support Committee. And so I kind of used to sit in meetings with Johnny Clegg, and we had a mutual friend, David Webster, who tragically was actually killed in the apartheid era, was assassinated. And in fact, Johnny Clegg has a song for David Webster. So I love his music. His music is absolutely remarkable, and it moves across borders and boundaries, culturally and musically. But there's also this wonderful connection with him when I was a younger person in South Africa, and you know, was in awe, of course, of his work and his contribution to social change in the African context, South African context in particular.
So growing up in South Africa, no doubt, has informed the work that you continue to do. It being a multilingual country with many official languages, you knew early on that some languages were considered more powerful than others. How can understanding languages and learning languages help to promote democracy rather than perpetuate inequality?
Well, interestingly, in 1976, which I know sounds like a long time ago, but I was a student at Wits University and was active in the Students' Representative Council, and actually wrote for the Wits newspaper, and actually went into Soweto just before the Soweto riots broke out, and you know, was very interested in what was happening in schools, and learned about the dissatisfaction of African students and the requirement to learn Afrikaans and to do particularly to do examinations in Afrikaans, which would have been extremely difficult for them. And then, you know, we went out, you know, out in 1976 in protest to Soweto riots. So that was a very important time for me to see, of course, the connection between language and power and social change. And of course, I recognized as a white person the privileges that I had. Because even though I did go out in protest, I had levels of protection that many black students didn't have, and certainly many black colleagues as well. So there are many connections here between language, power, race, education, human possibility that forged my understanding of language and power. And so when I came to Canada, did my PhD at University of Toronto, you know, I brought with me those understandings of language and power, and wanted to explore those in greater depth during my PhD and beyond.
Your work is often centered also around another aspect of language, and that's language and identity. How do you define these two things, and why is it also important to talk about identity when we talk about language?
Well, what I argue is that every time we speak, we navigate our identities, depending on who we speak to, when we speak, why we speak, and maybe why we don't speak. We are, in fact, navigating identity. And this is what I've seen in my research, which began with immigrant women here in Canada. What conditions do they speak under? When did they feel silenced? When did they feel they had to speak out despite feeling marginalized? It was about their identities. It was about their hopes for the future, but also their multiple identities. Because what I found, and this was part of the theory that I developed, is that you can't understand identity as essentialized, that you have one identity. You know, this is the real me, so to speak. We have multiple identities. And what I found in my research is that people speak when they speak from a position of power or from a position of a more powerful identity. And when people are positioned in inhumane ways, that's very difficult for them to speak from that position. But if they can claim a more powerful identity from which to speak, then they can enter into a conversation. So just to give an example, there was a woman called Martina who felt she was positioned as a broom when she came to Canada. She was an adult woman, had three children, but felt often that she was positioned in rather marginal ways. The way that she then spoke, how she claimed the right to speak, was through seeing herself as a mother, seeing that she had to speak on behalf of her children. Because if she did not speak out, it was not just a question of her being silenced. It was a question of her children not having opportunities in Canada. So she would claim the position of mother in certain conversations because she felt that that was the position from which she could speak. So that's the connection, part of the connection between identity, the multiplicity of identity, the conditions under which we speak, and issues of power. Because we can speak from positions of power, but it is very difficult to speak when we are positioned as powerless.
And these identities are shifting, as you say. They shift in the context of place. So it might be, community, it could be a classroom, it could be, a religious space, it could be in many, many places. And how does these shifting identities also affect the way people learn languages?
Well, first of all, when we think about shifting identities, I think you picked up the point that, yes, your identity shift across space in the sense that you may have one identity in a school context, but another identity in the workplace and another identity perhaps on the sports field. But then also identity shifts across time so that you may, at one particular point in your life feel that you don't feel that you can speak from a particular position, but over time you can claim the right to speak. So I do just want to make the point that, of course, identities shift across both space and time. Now, how this connects to language learning is that you learn a language by speaking. Of course, you can also learn a language by listening, of course, reading, writing, but you do need to interact with the language in order to be an effective language learner. So that is why it's important to ask the question, under what conditions do you speak? Why, for example, in the one particular case, when I was teaching adults in Toronto, I had a young man in my class who spoke very little. But I was invited to his home. This was in Toronto. And I found he was chatting, spoke a great deal about his love of cars and his desire to fix cars up and sell them as part of a job that he could have in the Canadian context. And I thought, my goodness, you know, he hardly speaks in class, but he speaks with great comfort in the home. And I saw that, well, obviously cars were of interest to him. So I started bringing in discussion about cars and about fixing cars and about the automobile industry into my classroom, and found that he became a more active speaker. So it provided an identity position for him from which to speak. So that's the kind of connection, you know, across space. But when I think about, changes of identity across time, one of the women in my earlier studies, Eva, she also felt initially as if she was an imposter here in Canada. But as she spent more time in Canada, she began to see herself as a multicultural citizen. And from that identity, she could speak. So what you see here is change across time, across space, as well as change across time, both of which lead to increased opportunities to learn and speak a language, in this case, English.
I'm going to play a clip now from a project that focused on Arabic language and culture, developed in a course titled Bridging Classroom and Community, Languages and Cultures in Action, offered in the Department of Modern Languages and Literatures at Western University in London, Ontario. Sara Ataya speaks about her experiences with language and identity.
And I'm Sara. وأنا هلأ عايشة بلندن وأنا من فلسطين بس كنت عايشة بالسعودية وبلبنان. Yes, so originally my family is Palestinian, but due to the current situation, we actually spent most of our life growing up in Saudi Arabia as well as in Lebanon. So my life was a little bit of a mix in terms of where I grew up and all the places that I visited. Okay, so this picture is of my family, me and my mom and dad, in Lebanon. We're standing right in front of the Roshi, which is the famous rock structure. This one is of me, my mom, and my cousin. We're standing at a beach in Lebanon. You can see the water. It's really pretty. My family originally was from Palestine, but due to the history and the politics of the situation in 1948, people resettled in Lebanon, and some of my family resettled in Saudi Arabia. So you have that experiences that they got firsthand in terms of being discriminated against because they speak with a Palestinian dialect. So language, I think, can be very controversial and political only when you think of like Arabic as a language, as well as all the different dialects that exist within each country. When I first moved to Canada, I was 10 years old. So when I first arrived, English was completely new to me. I did grow up going to a private school, so I learned a little bit of French, a little bit of English, but it was just the basics. I found that when I came here, things were a lot different. Obviously, the first thing was language barriers. So interacting with everyone in English was a big issue for me, right? Because I couldn't understand the language. So what ended up happening when I moved in, when I went to my new classroom, is all like I would find all the other students that were also newcomers who spoke Arabic, and then we would have like our little like Arabic-speaking friend group. You saw that across different language groups, right? So people who spoke Spanish or who spoke Mandarin. People kind of stick together because they're more comfortable speaking their native language. I think a lot of people experience this, like when you get made fun of for not pronouncing something correctly or not understanding what something means. I learned English and then I got so immersed into, you know, this culture here that I truly forgot how to speak Arabic. Like I could understand it. I could speak maybe a word here and there, but I wasn't as fluent. So I remember recognizing that and being like, I must learn Arabic. I must continue a conversation, even if it's basic. This one is of me and my two sisters. We're in Saudi Arabia, just hanging out at the Corniche, which is also the water. This is also me and my sisters just hanging out and eating some really random items. So one of us is eating chocolate, the other is drinking some milk. And that's me and my sisters again. I think this one was taken in Lebanon, I believe, on my grandma's bed. When I visit Lebanon and spend time with the family, to me that's like reconnecting to my Arabic language. Like spending a week in Lebanon taught me so much Arabic than I probably did in the past like 5 years living here. This is one of my favorites. So this one is actually of me and my sisters. We're both standing by the waterfall in Lebanon, and it's a really pretty picture. So I think it's interesting that something as simple as language can just have such an immense effect on the way people live.
Bonnie Norton, I think Sara Ataya gives us a real sense of some of the multiplicities in identity and language that you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, it's a very moving explication of her experience moving from Palestine to Lebanon to Saudi Arabia and then to Canada. And interesting how she uses images, because that's a she has photos, obviously, that she's sharing. This is, of course, another language. You know, language is another symbolic system, the images that we bring with us, right? But what I found very interesting about her discussion, and I was listening carefully, because as she was speaking, she said she came to Canada when she was 10 years old. And I thought to myself, I hope she hasn't forgotten her Arabic. Because one thing that happens when people come to Canada or any other immigrant country is they bring their languages, people bring their languages with them, and very often children lose those languages as they learn the dominant language, which is heartbreaking. And often parents are complicit in this, because parents want their children to succeed, and they feel that they must encourage them to learn the language, the official language of the country that they've moved to, which I understand. It's a very understandable response, but it's not. It's so unnecessary, because children will always learn the language of the official language of the country. But the danger is to lose the mother tongue, and so what we encourage parents to do, in fact, is to use the mother tongue in the home. And to embrace the mother tongue, because this is a very rich resource for children. And then as they move into schooling, they will learn in Canada English or French, but they will also have the mother tongue, which is a wonderful resource for them. It connects them, of course, to their histories, their grandparents, parents, but also brings another resource to the Canadian context. So this is, in a sense, partly why I got so actively involved in a project called Storybooks Canada, Global Storybooks, the African Storybook, because those are digital projects, free digital projects for parents, children, and schools, where children can read stories in the mother tongue that are also made available in English and French. So that our project Storybooks Canada, you can just check it out, storybookscanada.ca, has got 28 languages on that site, including English and French. And 18 of those languages are available in both print and audio. And people, parents, students, teachers can toggle between a mother tongue and English or French, so that they can learn English or French, but also maintain the mother tongue. So I was very excited to get involved in that project. Interestingly enough, it began in the African context with the African Storybook, where there are now over 200 languages over 1,000 stories, 6,000 translations. And I was the research advisor. I am the research advisor on that particular project that developed in South Africa with the organization SADI, a wonderful project. And with a group of students here in Canada at UBC, we repurposed 40 of the stories of the African storybook into Storybooks Canada so that children locally here could maintain their mother tongues, the range of wonderful languages, including Arabic, that you find here in Canada, and they learn English and French. And then from that, we actually we used that as the modular site. And from that, we developed a whole array of sites, which we have now 50 of those sites to be used all over the world across 5 continents that we've now called the Global Storybooks Project. So in a sense, I guess that project was about recognizing that parents need resources and children and students need resources in multiple languages, and they need to be freely available and can be used on multiple devices, which is these can be used on cell phones and laptops and iPads. So it's very exciting that I do have this theory of identity, but I also am very interested in practice. What does this mean for making resources available so that people can maintain can strive for multilingualism in the world in which we live and maintain the mother tongue while learning other languages? So there's a direct connection between my theories of identity and my practical work on digital storybooks.
But you've also said that when your language is valued, you also are valuing the person, that this literacy in the mother tongue, as you speak about it, actually multilingual literacy creates a really positive force in our society.
You see, that's this is of course work of Bourdieu, who highlights the relationship between language and power. But what I find very interesting about, you mentioned, I think, Arabic, that Arabic, of course, has different dialects, right? So you find English, for example, has many dialects, in different parts of the world. French has many dialects. And if you think of, I'm thinking in the US context, the United States context, there is African-American vernacular. Now, it used to be the case that many people would think that African-American vernacular, or what is sometimes called Ebonics, was somehow substandard English. But the work of scholars like William Lebov demonstrated that that Ebonics is a fully fledged language in its own right. It has standard systems, standard orthography, standard syntax, so that children shouldn't feel that there's something wrong with speaking the language, and that parents shouldn't feel that this is substandard, and that teachers shouldn't feel that they should discourage children from speaking African-American vernacular. So the issue, of course, is that children need to have access also to, dialects of power. So while one absolutely validates and recognizes Ebonics as a legitimate language, it's also useful for children to understand standard English and to speak it, so that you become, in a sense, bidialectal, so to speak, which gives you opportunities to operate across different spaces and across different times, depending on the purpose of communication. And that's why, for example, in our global storybooks, we have Storybooks Haiti and Storybooks Mauritius and Storybooks, which have the creoles that are spoken in Haiti, Haitian Creole, for example, Mauritian Creole. These are legitimate languages that children bring with them to classrooms, and we want to validate those, and we want children to be excited to be at school and using those languages. But at the same time, we want them to have access to standard versions of the language. So in our sites, you'll see that you can toggle, you know, between Haitian Creole and standard forms of French, and we've got Jamaican Creole, and we've got standard English. So, what one is trying to do is to provide opportunities for children across, you know, different genre, but at the same time to value the children and to value their languages in a very practical way.
I'm going to play a clip from UNESCO that celebrates International Literacy Day every September 8th. In 2019, its focus was on literacy and multilingualism, something we've just been speaking about.
Today, many people use more than one language in their everyday lives. Although there are 7,000 languages in the world, each linked to distinct identities, cultures, and knowledge systems, only some of them are promoted. Only 5% of the world's languages are present on the internet. 2,680 spoken languages are in danger of disappearing. And 40% of the world's population lacks access to education in the language they speak or understand. Our linguistic and cultural diversity is at risk. Literacy is key to addressing these challenges. In our increasingly globalized and multilingual world, we must invest in inclusive policies and practices that reflect the needs of learners. By providing access to a solid literacy base in a mother language, people are equipped to learn other languages. It is crucial to embrace linguistic diversity, both online and offline, if everyone should acquire, practice, and advance their literacy skills throughout life. On International Literacy Day, UNESCO calls on the international community to rethink literacy practices in today's multilingual world. Together, let's nurture inclusive and diverse societies where no one is left behind.
You are listening to the Blue Hour on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live streaming on CITR.ca. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Professor Bonnie Norton from the University of British Columbia. Bonnie, what resources do educators need to make multilingual literacy a reality?
That's a very big question for her. I guess there's a simple response and there's a more complex response. In terms of resources, of course, it's very helpful to have books and audio and media that will help people learn a language and that will develop multilingualism. But if you think about resources as being more political will on the part of governments and schools and communities, that's a different issue. Well, they are related at some level as well, because you want people to feel comfortable speaking their language. You want people to feel that they are not imposters when they speak their language or when they want to learn their language. I know that you know, sometimes there's a debate around, you know, everybody says, you know, when you come to Canada, you should learn English and French. And I think we would all agree that this is a good thing to do. It's very important to be a citizen, to be an effective citizen. At the same time, people sometimes get a little impatient when they realize that some people aren't that effective in learning English or learning French. And they sometimes feel that the people aren't interested in learning English or French as they move into Canada. But that is often not the case. You may find that a woman, for example, might be spending a lot of time in the home context, perhaps bringing up children. They don't have access to the spoken language, the spoken official language. And so they may live in a linguistic a very defined, perhaps limited linguistic community, despite the fact that they may wish to learn the official languages. They may even go to work. And as I found with some of the immigrant women that I worked with, in Toronto, a woman may go into the workplace but find that many people in the workplace speak one language. If they, for example, garment workers, and there are many people in the factory who come from a similar linguistic background, so that they may find that the language of power in that workplace may be Cantonese or Arabic or Spanish, and not English or French. So it's complex when you think about what resources are needed to help people to develop the knowledge of the official languages. I think this is why, you know, we've developed our digital storybook sites. I got an email on the weekend from somebody in Ontario saying that they have 1,400 newcomers to Canada, and they love using our Storybooks Canada site. And they spent many, I think they even said thousands of hours using the Storybooks Canada digital storybook site, because they have many different languages on that site, as well as English and French. So in terms of practical resources, it's wonderful that we can help produce those and make those freely available. But you also need to have a sense of a political will and a desire for the wider community to recognize the importance of multilingualism, and to encourage people, newcomers, to maintain their mother tongue and to share it with others who may be monolingual.
I'm going to play a small clip by a woman named Zubeda Desai. She's the Dean of Education at the University of Western Cape. And she's going to spell out what she would do in South Africa if she was a Minister of Education.
I would extend the use of African languages as media of instruction at least till the end of primary school, because I think by age 12, 13, children's language development would have been much more advanced than at the age of 10 at the end of grade 3. And then either carry on using the African language as a medium of instruction in high school or switch to English. But at the same time, I'm also not disputing the need to acquire English. English is a global language, whether we like it or not, and it would be foolhardy to deny children access to English. But you can also acquire English by learning it as a subject, and it's taught well by teachers who are proficient in the language, you see. So I think at the primary school level, you need to learn English as a subject very well, and then you use it as a medium in high school. But at the moment, they're expected to use it as a medium from grade 4, and they can't actually speak the language at all. I think all means can be used to learn a language, but one obviously needs to distinguish between different dialects, different variants of the language. But I think whatever tools are available, one needs to utilize. And I think it's important to hear the language being used, but likewise, it's important to read the language. And very few of our students are reading. So I think more emphasis needs to be placed on reading. There needs to be a culture of reading, whether it's reading on the Kindle, on your iPad, whatever, but you need to read, read, read.
So Zubeda Desai says we need to read, and early in multiple languages. Would you agree with her?
Yes. In fact, I do know Zubeda Desai. I have the highest regard for her work, and we have a great deal in common and have connected, you know, in many different ways over the years. And she's 100% correct. It's wonderful if children can learn in the mother tongue and then transition to official languages. We do have a Storybook South Africa site, actually, which is part of our global storybook site. And all those stories have been approved by the Ministry of Education, as this is part of the African Storybook Project. And so we do have, you know, many stories. I guess parents are, in fact, I have to acknowledge that parents are always a little bit worried about that transition process. You know, sometimes parents would say, we can teach our children Zulu, you've got to teach them English. So there is a little bit of that complexity, but what we need to do a better job of explaining to parents that in order for children to learn English, it's very good for them to have a foundation in the mother tongue. to have a foundation in Zulu or Xhosa or Sotho or Tswana, and then they can transition with greater ease to a second language. So that's one important issue that is important, you know, in the South African context. But also, of course, you do need resources and you need teacher training and you need classes that are a reasonable size. I've been in classes in Uganda where there are over 100 children in a class, all the children sitting on the floor and literally one small blackboard in the front with chalk and children struggling at the back to read. So, you know, one hopes that one can encourage children to maintain the mother tongue before transitioning to a language of wider communication. But it does require a wide variety of resources, you know, including decent class sizes and funding for teachers and teacher training. And that, of course, is more difficult in many countries in the world.
Now, what does it really mean to have a multilingual identity? Because this also can be confusing. Does it mean that one is fluent perfectly in each language, or is it about something larger, like just being familiar with the language and culture? Does that give a sense of being multilingual?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You know, many people feel, you know, they be asked, how many languages do you speak? And people will say one, two, and then they will admit grudgingly, well, they have learned a little bit of this language and a second language, and they can speak Mandarin and they can speak Swahili. And but people think that you need to be fluent before you can claim knowledge of a language. But in fact, it's very useful to get to know different types of languages, different scripts, different ways in which languages are structured. So that what you're doing is developing what we call language awareness, that that languages do operate differently. And sometimes when you just try and learn a second language, you learn more about your own language, which is very helpful. So in our Digital Storybooks project, what excites us is that children can very, and adults and parents can very quickly see the range of languages that are available and the different scripts and the different sounds of languages. And often when children realize that, for example, a Mandarin speaker may come to Canada and not know anything about English, but when they see that they can speak and read and write Mandarin, which we know is you know, a totally different script from English, they are in awe of their fellow students. And so what you're doing is that you're shifting relations of power between students when they realize that that of course a person may not be able to speak English, but they can speak many other languages and have knowledge of other languages. So a multilingual identity is about, in a sense, recognizing or striving for an understanding that we live in a multilingual world and that we should embrace that multilingualism in a positive way.
You've said earlier you've always believed in putting theory to practice, that you know, resources like digital resources in this increasingly digital world needs to be accessible, need to be freely available. And you've also noticed in your work in Africa that depending on where these resources can be, even something just like a cell phone, that's something that a lot of people in the world now own, can be an excellent tool for multilingual education.
Yes, this is what I learned from my research in Uganda, is that that people would use solar power to charge their batteries, charge their cell phones. And then you can take a cell phone and link it up to a projector and you can teach 100 kids in a class. So cell phones are ubiquitous in the African context. And there is the means through solar power and the wonders of Elon Musk, who himself is from South Africa originally, interestingly enough, what we can do with solar power and with energy and with technology. So what I've learned in my work in the African context is people are very keen to enter the digital world and to use digital devices to share information, to learn about the wider community, and to be more effective in their educational practice. It's inspiring to see that.
I'd like to play a small clip from a school teacher in Australia who works in the Purnalulu Independent Aboriginal Community, where she essentially is doing what we've been speaking about, taking that theory into practice right into the classroom. She's responsible for teaching literacy across all levels of the school. And what we will hear is this wonderful way of bringing multilingual education into the context of Australia.
Hi, my name's Cara Turner and I teach at Purnalulu Aboriginal Independent Community School. We are a remote Indigenous community located about 800 kilometres northeast of Broome in the East Kimberleys. Our community is called Frog Hollow Community. We have about 12 to 20 students on any given day at our school. All students are Indigenous. We have two full-time teachers and three full-time AEWs who are Aboriginal education workers. Our AEWs or teacher aides are real assets in our school, so they're the people that we can go to in terms of literacy planning. We can team teach, team plan, so I can ensure that the content that I'm teaching, the goals that I'm setting, are relevant to the context of our school. I specialise in literacy, working across all the levels. In terms of my approach to literacy at Purnalulu School, it's really important to have a strong understanding of the students' prior knowledge. I am teaching in a community with a culture that's different to my own, so I need to have cultural sensitivities and also a good understanding of cultural backgrounds and histories of the community members and the students that I work with. It's very important that there's a real respect for home language in the classroom. So that relates to two-way education, where although it is my job as a literacy teacher to teach standard Australian English, I also need to foster and respect the students' home language, which is Creole, Aboriginal English, and also Gidja, which is the local traditional language.
How do you say it in Gidja?
Diragan.
We ensure that we've got all of these languages embedded into not only our literacy program, but into all other curriculum areas as well. So this can be asking questions or reading books in the different languages, responding in different languages, and giving students the opportunity to code switch between their home language and school language.
Today we're going to be talking a bit more about Frog Hollow.
Today's lesson, our theme that we're looking at the moment is community, and we've looked at a number of different texts and narratives exploring different communities and comparing our community with other communities. I started off with what the students already knew about their own community, so they were able to have really rich conversations about the landmarks in their community, the things that they do in their community, and then today we linked it into Australian animals and the animals in our community.
On the ground.
So the students were able to have discussions using their Creole or home language, and I was able to respond in standard Australian English, and we labelled these animals and spoke about the environments they live in and their features. And the students also identified the names of these animals in Gidja, which is their traditional language.
Dogmop, Lawrence and Sophmop, that's right.
We ensure that it's not just standalone literacy that we're teaching. We have a real cross-curricular focus, so other curriculum areas are embedded into what we do, and there's nice flows between these other curriculum, such as with the mapping exercise we did, that's got a really nice link into the maths curriculum, as well as using Venn diagrams and mind mapping exercises, which is numeracy related as well. By discussing Australian animals and their habitats and life cycles and things like that, that comes under science, and also history of their local area. And of course, throughout the whole thing, Indigenous perspectives were embedded into what we were doing.
This was an exemplary teacher. I just was so impressed with her description of her practices in the Australian context and the link with, I'm thinking in terms of the link with my own work, on the Indigenous Storybooks Project that is led by Sarah Davidson, who's now at Simon Fraser University, I think is very much in the spirit of recognizing Indigenous languages, which are very important here in the Canadian context.
Bonnie, you often say that language learners can be ethnographers of their communities in and outside of the classroom. What do you mean by this?
In terms of language learners being ethnographers in their community, the logic of that stems again from the theory, because the question is, what identity position do you have when you engage with a new community? If you come into a new community and you see yourself as an imposter, as a foreigner, as potentially even somewhat unwelcome, it's difficult for you to engage with others target language speakers. But if you see yourself as an ethnographer, you have a different position of power relative to others in the community. You can go and observe, for example, in the Canadian context, you know, how do Canadians, you know, go shopping, and, you know, how do they talk to one another on the beach, and, you know, how do parents speak to children? What happens when I say hi to somebody at the bus stop? So that, you know, you can see yourself as an ethnographer who's seeking to understand the society, and rather than somebody who has no right to be there, so to speak, or perhaps is struggling for legitimacy within the new society. So I always give this as an exercise to students that I teach with, and say, go out as ethnographers and let's come back with your stories. When they come back with their stories, they share stories with one another, and they realize that there are commonalities, of course. Of course, there are also differences in the experiences of language learners, but they realize that that they're not alone as they seek to find a legitimate place within Canadian society, and that many people, you know, might experience feelings of isolation and marginalization. But many will also talk about, you know, friendly responses, supportive behavior. And then learners learn from one another. So that notion of being an ethnographer, I think, is very helpful for them as they enter into Canadian society.
And I think also from what we've heard, even in the case of the children in this Indigenous school in Australia, that children are bringing in all of these things from their communities and their understandings of their world into the classroom, and the teacher is utilizing that sense of culture, their understanding of, even if it's just animals that they can relate to. There is definitely something going on between teacher and student, very early learners in this multilingual education that you and your colleagues are promoting.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, when I've taught them newcomers to Canada, for many of the newcomers, I'm the only quote unquote Canadian that they speak to on a regular basis. Even though, of course, I wasn't born in Canada, and like them, I am also a newcomer to Canada, although I've certainly lived here many years. So the teacher's role is absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial, because often the teacher serves to bridge the newcomer with the wider society, help learners find doctors, find schools, find resources, you know, beyond the community. It's a major responsibility, actually, for teachers. And it's also very exciting, because you meet new people, and you learn about other countries, and you develop relationships with people. I've had relationships with students for many, many years that I've taught. And it's such a delight to see people, you know, moving beyond the classroom to work that is meaningful to them, and building up families. But the role of the teacher is crucial, I think, especially for newcomers.
Bonnie Norton, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. I'd like to finally ask you, what is your vision? What do you see in this world of multilingualism? and education and identity?
Well, I hold my breath because on the one hand, I see huge possibility for a world where we're a multilingual world, where there is mutual respect, where we embrace diversity, we learn from one another, we build a new world together. But then I see, of course, some very disturbing examples of communities who are retreating to ghettos, so to speak, who want to support, you know, a monolingual vision of a country and do not want to embrace newcomers and do not want to embrace multilingualism. And I think of this, you know, of course, not only in the Canadian context, but of course in the global context. And we see how quickly things can change. This is what is, you know, it's quite startling if you think about, of course, what's happened in the US, you know, as we've shifted political allegiances in the last, you know, few years, you know, what hope there was, you know, with Obama, and then, you know, how things shifted under Trump and how we now, you know, hope for the future with Biden. I guess the point is we have to always remain vigilant. We can never be complacent. Just when we think that everything is looking wonderful, you know, we can think positively and hopefully about the future. At the same time, we have to always be vigilant because, you know, issues change, economics changes, politics change. And so we have to continue that struggle. We have to see this as a journey that we can never give up on, and that we need to pursue these goals of equity and diversity and inclusion and multilingualism, and never become cavalier about the possibilities and work together, you know, through alliances with others, by continuing educating one another, much like this radio talk show is such a wonderful example of how we can reach out to the community and share what we've learned, you know, in the academic context, but also through our research and through our work across many different global sites. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak and to share my stories and my experiences, but also to listen to the wonderful experiences of others, whether in Australia or Canada. So this is something that we all experience, but I am optimistic that if we are vigilant, we can certainly, I think, continue to build a better world.
Thank you, Bonnie Norton. It's been such a pleasure to have you tonight. And I'd like to end with a song that you believe will inspire hope for the next generation. It's called Rise Again by the Rankin Family.
This song means so much because what it speaks to is how we live through our children and how our children reinvent their lives for the future, and how we can mentor children, but we also hope that children will also take charge and ownership of their future. And so we rise again through our children.
As if a child could tell us. Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.